This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
You've worked hard for what you have, your money, your assets, your 401k, and home. Isn't it all worth protecting? Nearly one in four consumers have been a victim of identity theft. LifeLock Ultimate Plus helps protect your finances with up to $3 million in reimbursement. LifeLock alerts you to identity threats you might miss. And if your identity is stolen, your dedicated U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. Let LifeLock help protect what you've worked so hard for. Save 25% off your first year on LifeLock Ultimate Plus at LifeLock.com/aware. Terms apply.
Today's a special one because I get to chat to not one, but two friends. After 150 or so episodes, it's nice to be able to shake things up a little. And today, I'm talking to the guys at Crawl Space Podcast. That's Lance Reinstierna and Tim Pilieri. They talk twice a week in their podcast about all sorts of mad mysteries, oddities, and true crime stories. They're known for being extremely knowledgeable on all these things, so I thought I'd put some questions to them. We talk about the case of Maura Murray, who went missing, and her case is delved into very much in their other podcast, Missing Maura Murray. We speak about the legend of Mothman, much to Lance's dismay, but Tim loves a bit of Mothman mystery. But we also delve into why people enjoy true crime, what it is about these stories that we like to solve, or if it gives us sort of practice for a zombie apocalypse or whatever it is. You know, there has to be a reason that people are so engrossed with or by true crime. We get into the social psychology, and I share some of the stuff I've learned from psychologists who came on this show. It makes for quite a nice dynamic, three people on the podcast, and I think it turns into more of a nice chat than a hard-hitting interview. So I hope this brings you entertainment, happiness, joy, excitement, frivolity, as well as true value and wisdom from the excellent Lance and Tim. Make sure to follow them both on Twitter and give Crawl Space a listen. It has a great TikTok and Twitter as well. Got some more big ones coming up in the next few weeks too. Catch my bonus section with Lance and Tim too by signing up on patreon.com/andrewgold. You guys are keeping this thing going. For now though, you're on the edge of true crime and missing cases with Lance and Tim from Crawl Space. I've got three people on for the, think of that everyone, for the first, it's a Crawl Space guy, so, and I know them and we're friends, so I thought we'll do both of you, and I wonder how my girlfriend Hawley's going to edit this. Is that, because do you guys ever edit three? Also, say hello and introduce yourselves.
Hello, I'm Tim Pilieri from Crawl Space and Missing. And I'm here with my pal, Lance. Yeah.
You were waiting for Lance to quickly say stuff, and he didn't there, did he?
That's right, yeah.
Well, I seem to be having some technical difficulties with my recorder over here, but I think it's recording. Anyway, what's going on? Yeah, this is so fun. I'm enjoying the fact that you opened the show with a technical reference to recording before introducing your guests. That's very... avant-garde.
People want to hear what's going on. They want behind the scenes, don't they? They want to know the how the sausage is made.
Well, I guess the answer there is yes. We frequently record with three people, sometimes more. It does take a touch longer to edit because of the three tracks or more as opposed to two, though.
That's the thing. And it's just a video. It's the video. But anyway, people listening, you know what, you're right, they're not interested in Lance, how are you doing? Are you stressed out? Because we edit this as I was saying, so it doesn't matter if you want to get stressed by stuff off air.
Yeah, no, I just don't see it doesn't look like I'm getting any levels on my Zoom over here, so I'm gonna have to cut over here.
Okay,
weird. I'm gonna have to figure that out later on. But this is your first threesome.
Yeah, I think it is my first, foray into a menage a trois. So,
Oh, yeah, honored. It's going beautifully so far. And I think, you know what, after doing 150 odd episodes, it's time, isn't it, to have like a few voices. You know what, though, when I listen to these podcasts and you hear all these different voices and stuff, you do forget who the people are, don't you? Like, people who don't know who you are already. So some people, what listeners is already know the Call Space guys, but because it's new people, you just get used to like, okay, one voice is lower voice and one voice is higher voice. I don't know which of yours is which.
Mine's the lower one.
Yeah, no, I think mine's the lower one.
Mine's a much lower one.
Mine's way lower.
Because most people listen on audio, they're just going, yeah, I don't know who these people are.
Yeah, we do some pretty good podcasts. I like to think we do Crawl Space, which I think is somewhat comparable to On the Edge with Andrew Gold, in that we do like to cover some fringe topics from time to time. But we also have a podcast called Missing, which is strictly about missing people and missing justice. And that started as Missing Maura Murray back in the summer of 2015.
Tell me about Maura. What was it? Missing Maura Money?
Missing Maura Murray. Yeah, Maura Murray, yeah. Was a 21-year-old college student from Massachusetts when she went missing in the White Mountains of New Hampshire in February of 2004. And very much the reason why we dove into that case was because of the online community that developed because of this disappearance and Maura's case being so mysterious. There was a lot of rabbit holes to go down. So the online community that developed naturally was fascinating to us. And initially, that was what we launched Missing Maura Murray to be, was sort of an exploration of that culture, the, I guess, web sleuth culture, but also specifically the people who look into Missing Maura Murray's disappearance.
Yeah, and it was in a time before citizen sleuthing was a big thing. This was before the Golden State Killer. It was before Michelle McNamara and that wave of individuals who weren't associated with law enforcement, weren't necessarily investigative journalists, but they had this fascination with solving cold cases. So that happened, you know, relatively recently in you know, historically speaking, and we had no idea what that was. And for us, the case of Maura Murray going missing, and the outside of just the incredible nature of the story itself, with the car in a single car accident at the base of the White Mountains in New Hampshire, and no evidence of her running off into the woods, no evidence of her existing beyond that time, you know, in February of 2004. That was really fascinating, but it was our introduction to these people. We would read the blogs and the blog posts. James Renner was probably the only person who was putting information out there to the public about the case and working on it. He was an investigative journalist and a writer, and people would go back and forth on his website, on his blog. And Tim and I were just like, this is incredible. This is a remarkable community and a remarkable energy. And we wanted to do a documentary about the folks that were involved with all of this, but they're very private. You know, they have their opinion. It's something that they do after work, and they don't want to necessarily be a spokesperson for, I guess, the opinion and then the case and their opinion on the case. So that's why we started the podcast.
These are the true crime fans, right? These are, and they are quite specific. Like, they're a specific group of people, the true crimeys, no one's ever called them true crimeys, have they? But I've just done that. I was at at CrimeCon recently in London. You guys were the one in the States, weren't you?
Yeah, that's right.
Was it nice meeting all these people in person, or horrible, just sort of brushing them off you? Don't touch me.
No, it's lovely.
Oh, no, it's definitely don't touch me.
No, I feel completely in my element at CrimeCon, talking with people who listen to our shows and know the cases that we talk about, you know, basically, or can talk about in our sleep.
Why does true crime bring people together in such a way? Why do you think people get so sort of obsessed with it?
Oh, that's a great question. And you get asked that a lot when you do these true crime topics. And I think in the beginning, my opinion on that was everyone loves a mystery, and they love not only the idea of a mystery, but solving a mystery. Everybody loves, you know, a Sherlock Holmes whodunit. And if you're the one that can solve it, you have achieved something that, like, is in naturally inside you. Everybody wants to solve the puzzle. And I think with the true crime, the fact that you're doing it and the result of it might bring some closure to families is good. I think there's a little ego involved in it, obviously. People want to be the one who solves it. And I think at some point it transitioned into more of a statement on how to say this without sounding, I don't want to insult anybody, but it started to transition, or part of it started to transition into a statement about law enforcement and how they're so overwhelmed and so overworked. And you hear all the time about if someone's not working on a case after a certain amount of time, it basically goes off the priority ladder. So I feel like there's a stronger spotlight put on law enforcement now too. So there's a little bit of that as well.
What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I find the element of technology and I guess constantly changing technology really interesting. When you look back at an older case, and you know, we're talking about Maura Murray's case, so that one I'll stick with. Like, you know, when she went missing back in 2004, and in the years right after that, there was Reddit, or maybe not Reddit, but web sleuths, message boards that popped up, and a couple other forums. And it's fascinating to look back at that stuff now and see how, you know, how it doesn't matter how much things change. A lot of those comments are essentially identical to, you know, what's happening today on forums in that case.
And I think as well, there was, if I may opine on your own topic and subject and stuff, I had this guy called Paul Bloom on, who's a philosopher, professor from Yale, and he said that because the ones you're talking about solving them, which I think you guys do focus on a lot, like, and that's fascinating, like the pattern seeking and solving human mind. But he was talking about you know, true crime and horror movies and stuff, and like horrible things that have happened to people in the past. You can't solve it, it's already been solved, but people want to hear it. And he was saying that he thinks that's the human brain gets some dopamine for watching those kinds of things, because it prepares them for if something like that ever might happen to them. It's just apparently why so many women are into true crime. Do you find that as does that ring true? And are there more women listening than men?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's really definitely true. Yeah. Probably like 75% or 80%, I would say, of our audience is women.
That high.
Well, look at us, Andrew.
I do think there's an element of safety. You know, you hear these stories, so you kind of know what randomness to somehow be prepared for. And I think on the dopamine thing, we have heard from other podcasters who cover like only solved cases, or actually podcasters who cover both solved and unsolved cases. They always say that their solved cases are more popular than they're unsolved. And I think it's for that reason. You know, you kind of want to see the story develop and you want to see it end. That isn't really the lane that we're in, though, with what we do at Crawlspace and Missing. We're also affiliated with a nonprofit called Private Investigations for the Missing. And it was founded by missing person Brianna Maitland's father. And so a lot of the cases that we cover on Missing come in by way of that nonprofit and get filtered through some investigators, and sometimes they're assigned private investigators. And then a lot of times we will podcast about it, and in the ones that are currently assigned private investigators, cases for private investigations for the Missing that have investigators assigned, they use the podcast as an investigative tactic to see if there are comments on the video or on social media. And that is one way that, you know, it's kind of a fun way to use social media and, I guess, emerging technology in helping.
Can I just go back to the guest that you said you had on that referenced horror movies, and maybe that was a way? Can you just open that up a little more? Because I didn't. Are you saying that he said he has a theory that people, when they watch something like a horror movie, it almost trains them to be prepared for something like that that might happen in reality, but they don't realize that they're doing it.
Yeah. So he's Professor Paul Bloom, and he's written many books, but his most recent was called The Sweet Spot, which was why, and I don't remember what the after the colon bit was. You know, they're always the long bits, aren't they? So it's like The Sweet Spot, colon, you know, why we enjoy suffering, something. And it's basically he says that we enjoy all different kinds of suffering, and he goes into which sort of suffering we like. For example, maybe spicy food, really hot showers. There's all different reasons for it. And one of them he looks into is like horror films and things like that. And one of the interesting things he found was that people who like horror films don't actually get less scared than people who say, oh, I can't watch that, it makes me too scared. It's just that they enjoy the feeling of being scared more. I know some people just don't get scared by the movies, but in general, that's what he found. But his theory was evolutionarily the reason that people are so addicted to watching these, because why would you watch these scary, horrible things? What entertainment is there in there? And for him, it is that, as you say, you know, without realizing it, it is that your brain is trying to train itself. It's looking for anything gruesome like that. We wouldn't see horror film as cavemen or whatever, but you might see a horrible thing that happens to somebody and you would want to have a look at that to learn for it not to happen to you. So that's why the brain releases dopamine, to make you more curious about those things.
That is really fascinating. And is that something that you are in line with?
I mean, look, it makes sense to me. Look, people, guests come on this podcast, they tell me stuff and I go, oh, that sounds probably true, but I don't know. What do I know? I'm just some guy and he's a Yale professor. But I think, you know, he would always say this is a theory. I just think these things are very, we don't know. There's probably a whole mix of reasons, but it does, I mean, what do you think? It does seem to chime with the very female, apart from your good looks, the female demographic that you guys have, because they are the people who might be victims of these crimes, although I think men probably are as well, aren't they, often?
Yeah. I think it's really interesting, because when I started my answer, it was the generic answer that I get because I didn't have any other way to put it, where I just believe that people love solving a mystery. And then that kind of gave it a little bit more meat. And so I am in line with that. I think that it is something that is realistic to explore. And a great example is, like, why do people eat spicy foods? It hurts you. It you know, you're sweating through it. Why are you doing this? Because it is releasing something. It's releasing like an endorphin.
Yeah. The spicy food thing, I think he was saying it's also about, I think that was from his book, because I have to read all these books for this thing. And I, you know how it is. You know, remember when you did like exams at school, you like forget immediately after the exam all of it. So you retain like 0.1% of the whole thing. But I think there was also this thing of like human consciousness lasts, like a moment of being conscious has somehow been defined and calculated by scientists as 2 seconds. Two seconds is your window of consciousness in every moment, if that makes any sense. And how happy you are, how good you feel, is often about the contrast between those 2 seconds and the previous and the next 2 seconds. So you're just, that's why you're always comparing to other people. You're always comparing the year you have with the year you had last year, but you're also doing it second by second. So you burn yourself with like hot water because it feels so good the 2 seconds afterwards, apparently. Although that doesn't ring as true to me, because I feel like the hot water itself is so nice. So I don't know. Look, a lot of it's theory, and I suppose it will vary from person to person. But I think what you said as well, Lance, I mean, it's the pattern-seeking mind. So I think that also has an evolutionary basis of like wanting to solve crimes and, you know, the Sherlock Holmes stuff. So I guess it's a combination of all of that, right?
Yeah, anything that puts me on the same, in the same conversation as a Yale professor, I'll take.
Yeah. Tim, what do you think?
Yeah, I could see it. I mean, I feel like a roller coaster, does that fit the same sort of category, I guess? Like, you enjoy the fear, but it's almost like you get the rush only when it ends and you're safe.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, evolutionarily, why would we... God, some people are listening to this going, these three guys talking about... They don't know anything. No qualifications, no university, whatever. And they're saying... So, and here I am going, yes, a person told me this on a podcast, so this is probably true. The roller coasters. Yeah, well, I imagine that kind of fear... I don't know. There's probably all sorts of things, isn't there? Maybe fear was good evolutionarily because in terms of roller coasters, because sometimes you have to go out, and if you're just scared, if you don't embrace the fear, you won't go and explore. Maybe that's another reason, you know. And when we explored and found new places to live and food and things like that, just don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of it just comes down to simple storytelling. You know, people like hearing stories too. And I think that dopamine rush, I could see that happening possibly more in the solved cases than the unsolved cases. You know, it kind of ties a nice little bow on it. I mean, even horror movies, even though they're not usually happy endings, at least there is an ending.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I think the release of the adrenaline and the cortisol that's in your brain when you're on that roller coaster, when you get that fear emotion that happens, you know that it's a hormone, right? That's released. The adrenaline, the endorphins, like that is something that's firing out of your brain. And there's a, you know, so now you're talking about like a scientific, like chemical thing that's happening in your body, and it could be very comparable, and probably is comparable. You have people who are adrenaline junkies, right? So it's like a drug. It's like the first time you do it, it's so great, and then it's like, well, I got to up it. I got to keep doing, you know, I got to keep upping the ante for my adrenaline release.
Yeah, and those people back in the tribal times would have been like they would have just know everything because they would have soaked up all the knowledge about all the bad stuff that can happen. I had a really interesting when I had a psychopath on the show called M.E. Thomas, and I always remember just, she sort of blew my mind a bit, because I remember saying, like, how do you enjoy movies and stuff if you don't have empathy? She has no empathy for the characters. She doesn't care about the characters. Particularly, we were talking about horror films and stuff, and I was like, how can you enjoy it? How can you get into the mind of the directors and the actors and stuff if you don't have empathy? And she was just like, you've got it all wrong. I was going to do her accent. I thought I won't, but she was like, "You've got it all wrong." No, okay. but she said, "You got it all wrong. When you're scared in a film, it's not because you're worried about those characters. Although I would actually argue with her that to an extent it is. But she said it's not because you're empathizing with them, because plenty of things happen in movies, like sudden scares, sudden things jumping out, that you're not scared because of you're feeling bad for the characters. You're scared because you were just scared. It has scared you." And that sort of blew my mind a bit. And that got me thinking, well, but why? Why do we go and do that?
Well, that's interesting. I like how we had emailed for several days before this interview, trying to come up with, you wanted like a few topics, and this isn't even close to what we had decided on. And I love it. I think it's a fun conversation, because this is not planned. We're using life examples to forward this conversation. That's super interesting, which is why I think your show is so great.
Oh, thank you.
But that is an interesting thing that woman said.
Right.
She's talking about the difference between a jump scare in a movie and relating to a main character and not wanting that main character to go through something difficult and bad and possibly die, because you are expressing empathy to a character. So that does happen in movies. If the character is well developed, you understand it's fictional, you know, it's fictionalized. Why do people cry at movies? Because they have empathy for what happened, you know? You identify it's fiction, but you can still have an emotion for it. It's interesting that she used a jump scare, though. So she is affected by jump scares.
Well, to an extent, yeah, I think. Because it's all on the spectrum as well, being a psychopath. So I think nobody is 100% that way. I think they. So she's like enough on the spectrum to be considered one by society, but she will get a little tingling. And those guys, the psychopaths, are adrenaline junkies. So they do mad things. I read her book, and some of the stuff she did was horrible. She talks about just drowning stuff in a pool. Like, she saw an opossum was in her pool, and she just sort of slowly pushed it under the water just to see, just curious. But she also did things like riding on, you know, jumping on the top of cars when friends of hers were driving them and stuff like that. They're risk takers. Her favorite film ever, because I had to ask her that then, I was like, what's your favorite film? And also, I was about the empathy. I think she would argue, and I don't know if she would be right, that when you feel empathy for those, like, you know, you feel emotional because something bad happened to someone in the film, maybe what you're really doing is just you're imagining it's happening to you and you're getting sad. And maybe that is what empathy is anyway. And so it's a whole, but her favorite film is Vertigo. Did you ever see that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
Yeah, it's great.
That's a great film.
So what she likes about it was that, was it Hitchcock? It's Hitchcock, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. Yes.
Is that there's a, I mean, I know, if this is a spoiler, but if you've not seen it, it's like 60 years ago now. So you've, the spoiler term, I think, has run out. But
I think it's past the statute of limitations on that one.
It is, isn't it? You're going to have to be, anything before the 1970s or 60s, I think you can spoil it. But somebody who's supposed to be dead is not, or something, you know, at the end. And she was like, I love that he manipulated us, Hitchcock, and he was like, screw you, I'm making you think this. And that's how she thinks. So weird, isn't it?
I was going to ask you if we could guess what movie was her favorite movie. And oh, no. I don't know if I would have. I think I might have guessed, like, maybe Psycho. I probably would have said that as a joke.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that would have been, maybe that is one of her favorite. Hey, you know what people are thinking now, though? Because you were talking about tying up loose ends and solved and all that kind of thing. So what has happened with Maura Money? Maura Murray.
Maura Murray.
Yeah.
Maura Murray's case is still unsolved at the time of this recording in 2022. Yeah, it's been a long time. Her sister, Julie Murray, has taken up the fight and advocating for her sister's case and is doing a great job, especially on TikTok, where I've seen some of her videos that are really creative and, like, just great use of the information and trying to reach people. You know, I think it's really effective. But unfortunately, it is still unsolved. Now, let me ask you something on the last topic, a psychopath, right? Do you think there are some, like, evolutionary benefits to having less empathy? I'm not saying I want that, but I'm just asking that question, throwing it out there.
I don't know about evolutionarily, but I would probably, and I would say societally, definitely less. I think in society, God, I think I'm hearing listeners go, God, it's going to be one of those ones where he talks about his thoughts a lot. Switch off. Don't want to hear that. None of this pseudoscience. In society, I think society, okay, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? It's a really obvious, it's something you hear since you're a kid. You hear that. I never really thought about it too much. I started thinking about it more often recently. If you think about when society has gone wrong, and wrong is subjective, but there are times when I think all of us can agree, the Nazis, probably the Soviets, Mao, all these different people, we can all agree they've gone wrong. In most cases, like, it wasn't people sitting around going like, mwahaha, we're going to be evil and do these horrible things to the Jews or whatever. They were thinking the Jews are the bad guys who are doing this, and we're the righteous good guys, the Spanish Inquisition, the Soviet, the SS, all these people, we're the good guys, we're gonna, you know. So I think often it's that if you're too empathetic, it might cloud judgment. And I think that's probably happening in some of the sort of culture wars today, though I won't say lest I be harangued and attacked and murdered. But sometimes instead of science and facts, we can be misled. So I think you need a bit of, but if you don't have any empathy, then you'd get a bunch of scientific people just going, well, we shall lead the tribe and anyone weak will be left behind. So you probably need to have a bit of both, right?
Of course. I think that there's a balance with everything, that you need to have the understanding that there's gray areas and not a black and white scenario every single time. And every decision is a difficult decision if it's going to be, you know, impactful to society. So, but I would say, like, being a devil's advocate in this conversation and presenting another question from the other side, what would be the problem with a society that says, if you're not strong enough, you don't survive?
Well, I think on the surface, there would be a lot more violence. You know, I think the kind of person who doesn't have a lot of empathy doesn't hesitate as much when being faced with the thought of hurting someone or not. You know, I think even in what we do, Lance, like, and Andrew, like, if we were to just, like, say, tweet out our opinions on certain cases and we think this guy did it, and, you know, like, and things like that, like, I guarantee you we'd get more followers. Now, it wouldn't be ethically or, you know, better, you know, and we'd get a ton of blowback. But if we're the kind of people who don't have that constant empathy, then why would we care? We wouldn't. We'd just be like, oh, great, more followers.
I think that's a really good point. It's a great question as well, because it stumped me. I like those questions. I'm like, oh, because I thought you were going to say what I hear a lot, which is like, what's the problem with everybody having empathy? And I'd be like, oh, but that's what I said, because of the Stasi and all that. They thought they had him. But that's really interesting. But I suppose, like, so the thing about humans is we're a really social animal, and social cohesion was really important. I was reading recently that initially, obviously, as you see with monkeys and stuff, it's believed that we were into like grooming, as in like sort of licking each other's heads or whatever mad thing they used to do. And that was like part of social cohesion. It was a way that tribes would sort of get together. It was gave apart from meals and stuff, it was an excuse to get together and be together. And that was what kept tribes together. But apparently it's quite time consuming, all the grooming, and doesn't work. The dynamic doesn't really work once you go past 70 or so in a group. And our groups apparently went to about 150. So grooming got replaced by gossip. So gossip became the big thing. And for gossip to be interesting and for it to work as social cohesion, we also needed to be really curious people, and I suppose quite empathetic people. Because if you've got no empathy, you're not going to be really interested in what anyone's telling you about their lives, which, to be fair, a lot of us aren't anyway when we listen to other people. And I suppose what's good for the tribe in that sense is probably what's good for the individual within it, and those individuals and those tribes will pass on their genes more. Because if it's just... if there's a tribe without so much social cohesion, I think it might not do so well as a team when they're fighting against the elements, whether that be climate or animals that are going to kill them, or just hunger and stuff like that. So it's just team building, I suppose. So that's why you need that big mix of empathy and I suppose psychopathy, and most of us lie somewhere between the two.
Now, what about if you are looking to form a cult? Do you think that, by and large, cult leaders are psychopaths?
Probably. I think a lot of them have to be. I expand the word cult, so I interview a lot of different cult people, and I expand cult to mean anything. And some cult survivors have a problem with that. They don't like that, and I understand that as well. But I would say, like, there's a lot of gym cults. There's a lot of, like, juice cults, you know, where they really, you have a lot of pressure to stay in. Now, out of 10, it's not the same as, like, a Jonestown massacre kind of thing. It's not even the same as like a Scientology kind of thing. So I think, again, it's on a spectrum. But I would say that even politicians, I mean, if you go through like the same kinds of processes we all went through, like school, friends, whatever, and you come to the conclusion in your like 20s, like, I think I'm somebody who should be the leader of this country. I just think like this person's a psychopath or has like a lack of self-awareness. And that's whether they're left wing, right wing, centrist, whatever they are. I think like, and I'm happy those people exist, because you need someone to lead. You can't all just be us sitting here like, well, I hope someone leads the country. But yeah, I don't know. What do you think about cult leaders?
Yeah, I think that's a good point about politicians. Do you think there's something about showing confidence that inspires people, whether it's, you know, I guess truthful confidence or not. I feel like we've had this conversation a lot lately when we're talking about con people.
Well, an interesting thing I heard recently was that I can't remember what it's called, but there's some sort of theory, or I don't know, but basically you can show pictures of leaders or potential leaders to children, and they can choose who they like, and that person almost always wins the election. So a huge part of it is about people's looks, which it shouldn't be. It doesn't mean that they're better looking. I mean, obviously Donald Trump was not, like, he's not a handsome man, but there must be something in his posure, or his gait, there's something about him, and it probably is that sort of confidence that you're talking about. So maybe that is what we find appealing.
I would say that there is less to do with Donald Trump's gait and more to do with the web that has been woven from his inner circle, and the web of power that has just been in place for in his family for 100 years. And it's just been so deeply woven into these organizations that he literally can be and is a rambling buffoon, and people are still following him because they were, I guess, born with the name on the tip of their tongues for, you know, as long as they can remember. But then you can have, like, religious leaders too. Like, is it religion? You know, do you have ministers who oversee their sermons? Like, are these psychopaths, or is there a spectrum there too?
Well, I think that exorcist, I think he might be a psychopath, the guy I interviewed. All these, you know, it's hard to know. We can't really judge. And I guess each case is a little bit different. But I just think if you're somebody who thinks I am the son of God or whatever, and I'm going to speak to you through God and that kind of thing, they could argue, on the other hand, that they're actually really empathetic. And that's what religion is, because I think empathy can inspire a lot of religious thinking. And there's loads of empathetic people who have been very religious, and they sort of use that as their set of rules, the religious stuff, to go about doing what they think are nice and righteous things, right?
I think that religion has a lot to do with pretty much every war that's ever been started. And then they use it as an excuse. For example, in our country, last week, Roe versus Wade was just overturned. Now there's a huge religious right that is supporting that being overturned, and it has nothing to do with religion. The people who overturn that don't care about religion. They don't care about the kid once it's out of the womb. There's no health care. There's no education. There's nothing that's given, you know, that this kid's gonna get from the government. They don't care. That has its roots in racism. Roe versus Wade. They just needed a way to control the black population without saying that they were doing it. Not to get into a whole angry history lesson, but, you know, that's religion is used all the time by people in power to manipulate society. And it's because people, I don't know, want something to believe in.
Yeah.
They need the excuse.
That was that drug thing, wasn't it? Was it Reagan or Nixon? It was like the war on drugs. Basically,
it was Reagan, yeah.
To control the black community. By the way, we've lost about probably 30% of the listeners, but the other 70% are loving it.
We still got about a half hour to go.
We'll shake off.
Found a way to lose them as well. It's really interesting, the abortion, because people are always. I get people messaging me saying, because obviously I do different political things and stuff, and people are often messaging saying, you know, can you see if you can get someone on who is pro-life, as in they don't want abortion to be legal, but who is not at all religious, who is a secular person. And I'm yet to come across that person. And to me, that's enough of a reason to, you know, dismiss it. I've looked into abortion a lot. I don't understand. And if anyone's listening now going, well, I do like abortion, I my biggest fear is just, you know, losing listeners because I have a different political view to them. Because the more important than abortion and all that thing is that my podcast is successful. That's much more important. So just if you're not happy, listen to the next one. Keep on listening.
I think if you had any listeners from the South in America, you might have lost a little percentage there as well.
Yeah. Well, if I hadn't, they'd just gone now.
Yeah, I feel like that you were heading right towards a Russ Perot impression. pulled up just short of going fully there, but it was very enjoyable.
You almost went Russ Perot.
Russ Perot was an American business magnate, billionaire, politician, and philanthropist. I didn't know who that was, but I do now.
Yeah, he ran for president.
Is that because I was saying stuff like, I don't care, I just want my podcast to do well, my own thing?
It was the accent specifically. You sounded like him for a second.
I do declare.
If you could bring it up like one octave, you'd be good.
Why do they always say they declare? Why do they don't they just declare stuff without having to say I do declare?
Oh, they have to really emphasize it.
Religious right, more like religious wrong.
I was just thinking, Tim, what an amazing American accent, and then I remembered that you are from there.
Yeah, that was my Ross Perot.
Can you do British accents?
Oh, of course I can. I love doing my British accent.
Not bad, actually.
It's actually good. Very good.
You've gone too far, Lance.
I'm more Cockney.
More Cockney.
I'm more Cockney.
That was good.
Hey. Well, I want to tell your listeners, or the listener that's left, that we didn't, Ross Perot was not on the agenda either. We are all over the place.
It's all unplanned, isn't it? But what we did plan, because people are going, right, what about Mothman? Mothman, are you guys always talking about?
Yes.
Who's Mothman?
Yes. Going on mute.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Andrew, for mentioning Mothman. It was hilarious.
let's talk about Roe versus Wade again.
No, Mothman. People want to know about Mothman.
You know, I am obsessed with Mothman, or the Blackbird of Chernobyl, as we learned recently. And there was the original Mothman and a book called The Mothman Prophecies that was written by a guy named John Keel, who was later portrayed in a movie called The Mothman Prophecies, starring Richard Gere. And it's something that happened in the late 60s, where there was a bunch of sightings of this winged humanoid in the Point Pleasant, West Virginia area. And the book is fascinating, but the story kind of culminates with a bridge collapse. And so it sort of led people to think that this Mothman was kind of a harbinger of doom, because he was, I think, sighted or seen on the bridge at one point, like sitting perched atop it. I'm not sure if that's even a credible eyewitness report or just sort of after the fact had mentioned, because this was a real bridge collapse where a lot of people died. Very tragic. But we spoke about the Mothman recently on Crawlspace because there were sightings in, I think it was July or the summer of 2019 around Chicago and Lake Michigan. And we had on an author who wrote a book sort of compiling those eyewitness reports, which are, you know, very modern and, really interesting to me. I don't know what it is, but I love cryptid mysteries like Mothman, like Bigfoot, and Lance just completely hates it, and which is now part of the fun.
So that's venturing into myth then, isn't it? And so Lance, you're not having any of that.
No, I really appreciate the story. I really appreciate the sightings and the exploration into that particular world, that cryptids. It's very fascinating. Enough's enough with Mothman.
Yeah, no more Mothman.
The story's been updated.
We need the updates.
We did, who's the guest that we had on that you referenced was Tobias Whalen, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, super interesting dude. If you ever get the chance, maybe we can make the introduction. You can chat with him. Him and his wife run the Singular Fortean Society, which is dedicated to all things paranormal, supernatural, cryptids. And the book was called The Lake Michigan Mothman?
I believe it was called The Lake Michigan Mothman, yeah.
I've had some of those times when I've had to interview, because you know I do Sean Atwood's show on Wednesdays on YouTube, so I don't have as much choice about who comes on. So I do have, often there's Bigfoot believers and people who say that they were abducted by aliens and have been living in space for 30 years and those kinds of things. And it is a hard line to sort of, you know, straddle, because you don't want to make fun of someone, especially someone who's mad, but you know, I don't know what to do. But Tim, you don't really believe in Mothman, do you?
I mean, I believe that there were really sightings, 100 or so sightings of this winged humanoid over around Chicago and Lake Michigan in the summer of 2019. That was written about in legit publications like The Guardian, I think, and Vice and things like that. So people were seeing something. That's clear to me. Do I think it was like really a harbinger of doom with glowing red eyes who, you know, kind of defies gravity as we know it, because we know birds are sort of hollow, have hollow bones. So no, I probably don't think so, but you know, all it takes is one of those reports to be something that no one knew about. And now we're cooking with gas.
Well, I liked Tobias's analysis of these sightings, and he will do a lot of research into it. He'll look at the pictures, if any pictures have been sent to him. And one of the solutions that he came up with was that some of these sightings might be attributed to climate change, where birds like cranes, these giant cranes, are being forced out of their habitat, and people in areas that wouldn't typically see a crane like this see something like that in the sky, and they take a picture of it, and you know, the thing's moving, so the picture's blurry, and the story develops from there. But you know, I will say it's sort of a shtick that we do with Tim loving it and me hating it. I do find it super interesting, especially the more famous Mothman sighting where the bridge collapsed. And it's interesting to me that people can have their imagination run away from them, but to have that collectively happen in a time with no social media and all the stories are so similar is just a fascinating concept for me as well.
Yeah. You're hoping my editor will clear that up and listen carefully enough to hear that, but she's my girlfriend actually. And she'll be listening to it quite fast and she might not, but now she'll definitely have heard me saying this and she'll be like, oh, now I do have to go back and do it. Although now she can't because yep. I've just done this whole bit. So she has to leave that in as well. So you're fucked, mate. I was on Jordan Harbinger's podcast, speaking of Harbingers of Doom, and he gets now 350,000 listens per episode, right? Three episodes a week.
Oh, pardon us.
That's insane, isn't it? And I was, so obviously it was a big deal for me and all that. And I was saying the word to disavow someone of something, which is, it's disabuse someone of something or to disavow someone. And I don't know why, but that was like the day that I decided to say it like nine times. I'd never said that word before. And I used it wrong like nine times. And he actually then had to tell me like, when you say, do you mean disabuse someone? I was like, yeah. And then my whole facade of like the clever English guy with the accent who knows all the words was just like ripped away. And I'd said it too many times, so it couldn't be edited out. And that was, and I had to be like, oh man, I don't care about that stuff. Like whatever. But secretly I was thinking that, oh, I made a fool of myself.
Now, see, I feel like you have this like very intelligent English guy thing going, but you also have this humble thing that bumps into that. So like, as long as you just.
The Hugh Grant, like, oh, shucks thing.
yes, exactly. Very much of that. So as long as you bring that out too, then you're all set no matter what.
And just, you know, rest assured, if that were me in that situation, I would have been saying disemboweled. I would have been saying disemboweled.
We need to disembowel pedophiles of the idea that it's okay to have adult child sex. That is what I was talking about, actually. So,
sure.
Yeah.
Why not?
Tell me about Connecticut River Valley Killer.
My goodness.
Yes. Where to begin on that? Well, we are starting a project that is a podcast and documentary, and it is about this Valley Killer who killed a lot of women in the 70s and 80s, and it's in an area that's somewhat close to us in New England, and we've been following this case for years, and we're trying to do a couple of projects on it.
Wait, there's a New England?
Yes, New England is...
I knew that.
Oh, I was ready to give you a good geography lesson.
Yeah, you have done already, Lance. I think it was you, it wasn't Tim, was it? Lance, it was you ages ago. You were showing me like a farm you were going to and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I know what's happening.
The Dean Farm, I believe I was showing you, because yeah. I don't go to any other farm.
Yeah, that's what you showed me, so I know what's happening.
But the name is a little misleading, and part of our goal, like a small part of our goal with our project that we're working on, is to assign a new name to the serial killer, because the Connecticut River, while it does run a bit in the state of Connecticut, it is mostly in Massachusetts and then up through the border of New Hampshire and Vermont. So the Connecticut River spans, I guess, three or four states, but the area we're talking about is the valley between New Hampshire and Vermont that is divided by the Connecticut River. And that's where the majority of the murders took place. And the fascinating part about that area is that it's very small. The community is very small, very tight-knit on both sides of the border. And about a few years, 3 or 4 years before the first Valley Killer victim was discovered, there was another serial killer in the 60s, in the mid to late 60s, named Gary Schaefer. And he murdered a series of children and kidnapped and murdered women and kidnapped one woman who escaped, and that eventually led to his arrest. So they go through this incredible time where they have this serial killer. One of the first, I think this was before they even coined the term serial killer. So they had this killer in the area who was caught, captured by local police and state police, and big victory. And then right after that, right on the doorstep, is the Valley Killer, who is still unapprehended and probably, I mean, just as bad as that first one, as Gary Schaefer. So that area, within the span of a few years, has two prolific serial killers. One of them is still at large, and his latest victim, so he was active, as far as we know, all the documented victims were between 1978 and 1988. The last victim's named Jane Borowski, who was attacked in the town of Keene, New Hampshire. And a lot of people know Keene, New Hampshire because of Keene State College. It's close to Mount Monadnock. It's a little bit of a hub in, I guess, south central-ish New Hampshire. So she was attacked in 1988 after leaving what was a community staple in the Cheshire Fairgrounds event. So every summer, late summer, August, this area would have this carnival type event. There was like bands playing and Ferris wheels and food and games. And it was like this long weekend event. And she left. She's 7 months pregnant. She gets into, I think she had a Firebird, either a Firebird or a Trans Am, but it was a pretty badass car for the time. And she gets in her car and she's driving home, or driving to a friend's house, in the direction of a friend's house. And she stops at a gas station. And she's thirsty, so she decides that she's going to get a drink out of the vending machine. She goes to the vending machine. She puts in her money. It doesn't accept her money, so she has to go back to her car and get another dollar. She goes back, gets the soda. Ironically, it spits out her last dollar, so she gets her first dollar back. And she gets into her car, and she's approached, this other vehicle pulls up in a Jeep Wagoneer, and she's approached by this gentleman who exchanged some words with her through the window. And he asks her if she's from Massachusetts, and she's the one that beat up his girlfriend or something. And he ends up attacking her, pulling her out of the car. She's kicking, she's struggling. She ends up shattering her windshield because she's kicking so much, and she's fighting back and fighting back. And finally she kind of frees herself, and she's made a scene. And she says to him, and this is probably her biggest mistake. She says, this is definitely her biggest mistake. She says to him, "What about my windshield, asshole?" And then he comes back and he tackles her and stabs her 27 times, including in the jugular. She's like fighting it off with her hands so that he doesn't stab her baby. And he's done his job. He gets back in his vehicle and he leaves. And while she's bleeding out, she gets up, gets into her car, and drives to her friend's house. And as she's getting to her friend's house, she ends up coming up behind him, the guy who attacked her, in his car. And she takes the turn into her friend's driveway. Her attacker is there at the front of the driveway, kind of slowly driving. The guy comes out of the house and puts a pillow cushion or something on her to like stop the bleeding. They call an ambulance. The guy drives away. She ends up surviving. Her daughter survives, and her daughter has like a great, so Jane has a grandkid. So her daughter has a child as well. We're talking with her. She's a major part of the story, and getting some really good stuff. So there's a big human element to it.
And we're looking for that asshole.
And how long ago was this? This was some time ago.
That was 1988.
So that asshole is 34 years older.
Yeah, maybe not alive. But we did ask Jane about her use of that word. It's really hard to come up with a better word for that guy. It's just such a general word for a bad person who's acting badly. But we even kind of joked about calling the podcast the asshole of the valley. But we don't want to name it after that asshole. But we even spoke with Jane. Like, do you use that word anymore? Like, can you imagine that? Like, you know, that, because the guy turned around after that and you know, stabbed her more violently. It's just why. And what is it about that guy too? Like, is that word is some trigger for that guy? Like, I hope he's listening. He is an asshole.
And it does sound like it's a joke, but it is kind of funny. But in that moment, the worst moment of her life, she attributed that word to an individual. Like, that's the standard that she set for that word. So if someone cuts her off in traffic, what are they? They're certainly not an asshole, because that's not the caliber of asshole according to Jane's barometer on what it takes to be an asshole. Like, that person's just merely like an inconvenience.
Asshole's the worst thing for her. Whereas I think we spell it differently over here, like A-R-S-E, asshole. But
I think that's how she called him that.
I think it would sound a bit glib, wouldn't it, if you had that as the title, sort of, you know, a bit.
That's why he attacked her. He was like, "You glib, you're so glib."
But I had another professor on called John McWhorter, and he talks about like how offense has changed over the years. And so it used to be religious words that were the most sacred that you can't possibly say. And now it seems silly. Like, it always seems very sacred and whatever at the time. And now it's like damn and hell. Like, okay, who cares about that? Even though I know in America, in some places, like kids say hecka instead of hella. Like, that's hella cool. What do they say? Hecka cool. So even now they have to be a bit careful about some of the religious words. And then it became all about bodily stuff, like, you know, with the Victorians and the Puritans and stuff. So those words like asshole, because it's part of the body, that was like as sacred as it can get. And we moved on from that about 15, 20 years ago, when like fuck, shit, ass became less offensive. You still don't hear it on the radio though, but we moved on to identity words, which even now, because we're going through that now, so those words seem like they're really bad words, but maybe in 50 years. So words, the N word, the F word for gay people, and other words that might describe, you know, minorities and stuff like that. So now stuff like assholes, nothing. But at that time, that might have felt like someone saying the N word or the F word for gay, you know, that kind of thing. It might have felt like that, and it was bigger then.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Yeah.
I'm really trying to get, because you guys throw around the word cunt all the time, and I'm really trying to get that flying here in America. I think that we need to take the sting out of that.
Yeah, well,
that word.
That's a really interesting one, because that's right in the middle. If we move from body words to identity words, In the UK, it is just a body part and doesn't mean anything more. And you call a guy a cunt or like a shit, a fucking cunt, whatever. In America, it for whatever reason, who knows why, but it started to get like misogynist connotations. So it became an identity word, which is pretty offensive to women. Like, their identity word is like, you're a like cunt. Like, this is the name of the vagina. But because it's got that sort of identity thing, but it's also, it's not really an identity thing. It's caught in America, I think, between those two places.
Yeah, I guess it kind of is an identity thing in America if you only call women that, right?
Yeah, maybe that's what happened.
It's kind of like being, for men are called dicks all the time, you know?
That's true. You wouldn't call a woman a dick, and maybe you should.
Right.
You were talking about, and a sort of last big point here, victimless crimes.
Oh yeah. See, that was a subject that just started popping up a little bit more recently. We had heard a lot about victimless crimes when we were producing the Empty Frames podcast that we have like three seasons of, and it's primarily about the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist that took place in Boston in 1990 in March. And we threw that around a lot, that this was a quote, fun mystery, it because it was victimless. And the more you dig into it, it's like, well, there are victims here. Aside from the physical human that is tied up down in the boiler room while the crime is being committed, I mean, is he a victim? He must have suffered some sort of trauma from that. The people who appreciate art no longer get to see this art. The museum itself, the memory of Isabella Stewart Gardner, who loved her art, is the memory of victim. And then we were talking about D.B. Cooper and how he hijacked a plane while he was in the air and jumped out after securing a ransom of 200 and something thousand.
I think it was 200.
Yeah. And we kept saying, well, it's people love that mystery because he, you know, no one's found him and it's essentially victimless. And we said that on the air and we got some comments saying, well, perhaps you should consider the flight attendants who knew that this was happening. They were probably terrified. And we've talked to people who have researched D.B. Cooper quite a bit. And as far as this person's found, a lot of the flight attendants did speaking engagements and went public with what happened. And none of them seemed like they were truly affected by it. And he didn't let anybody on the plane know that they were being hijacked. Like the people found out after the plane made an emergency landing and they were told that they were hijacked and the guy jumped out. So they had no idea. So I just thought it was an interesting philosophical question to present at this episode. Like, what's your feeling on what is it? Is it just, what's the word to use when one word and another word don't go together? An oxymoron to say victimless crime? That shouldn't even be together in a sentence.
Yeah, I suppose they're victims because the passengers' days have been ruined, right? Because they've landed somewhere else. And it's not the worst kind of victimhood, is it? I've had my day ruined. But if somebody came over to you and picked you up while you were walking down the street and then moved you like 1,000 miles away, and then you had to be like, oh, what am I going to do now? You'd be like, I've been the victim of some sort of weird attack here.
True. Yeah. it's a smaller scale, obviously, than, you know, missing person or being the loved one of a missing person or a murder or something like that, or being the victim.
Or Jane.
Yeah, or Jane, who was nearly killed herself and her daughter. And I do think the Isabella Stewart Gardner museum heist made us all victims, honestly. The culture, the art. If people who enjoy art are victims in that case, because there are masterworks that will probably never be seen again, at least in good condition, I think it's fair to say. So that, you know, we're all victims a little bit there. And obviously Ms. Gardner, but she was gone afterwards. And, you know, in D.B. Cooper's case, I do, you know, I don't really regret using that term in the, I guess, the intro of that episode, Lance, because we only got a comment or two. And, you know, I think it's about as victimless as we can get when, you know, we're talking about a spectrum. Like, if you look at every single case we've ever covered or episode we've ever done, like, that one was on one complete opposite end of the spectrum to almost every other episode. So at least comparatively for us, I think it's safe to say that was victimless.
Where can people go and find your stuff? Where do you want to send some of these eager listeners for more podcast stuff?
Whoa. I don't think you gave your answer to this.
I did. I said there was a victim. There were victims. Oh. I think it's a really interesting point, actually.
Oh, you use that. Okay.
It's something that I've actually never thought about that before. So I really like that. And is there such a thing as a victimless crime? And I think let's leave that to the listener. Get in touch with all three of us separately. Don't do like a chat by putting, I don't know if they could put like the four of us in a, we'll be in loads of group messages on WhatsApp with listeners. But you know, let us maybe tag us all on Twitter or something and let us know what you think. Cause what is the most victimless possible crime? I suppose you could say not paying your taxes, but because it's such a tiny amount, you know, in terms of the victims. But if we all did it, I don't know. I suppose taxes is close to it, isn't it? Not declaring something is very close to victimless.
Yeah, I think when banks get ripped off, people don't have empathy for banks because they know that money's insured and it's not coming from anyone's pocket necessarily.
Yeah, but it's got to come from somewhere. I don't know anything about economics, but when more money has to be made to go somewhere, there's inflation. So I don't know. Someone get in touch with us all. Let us know the perfect. I don't do this every week, by the way. I don't end on like a really traditional TV 1980s. Let us know your thoughts. Write into P.O. Box something.
Let us know your thoughts.
Miss Piggy? So was that Miss Piggy or was that Kermit or was it Jordan Peterson?
That was Ross Perot again.
Chime in the comments. Oh. We'll see you on Twitter.
Oh, right. At first it sounded, I thought it was Kermit. And I like...
It was a little Kermit-like.
It was Kermit.
That's more like this. We'll see you in the comments section.
I like that. And I think it sounds very similar very to subtle. Bill Gates as well. He's got that voice.
You know? I'd have to listen more to him. I don't know.
Here at Microsoft... here at Microsoft, and then Jordan Peterson as well. Like, it's you know, men are suffering. So that's you never seen those three in the same room: Kermit, Jordan Peterson, and Miss Piggy. Where did you tell me? I've got to go and play football. Tell me where people can get your stuff.
Yes, check out crawlspace-media.com for links to all of our sites, or you can search Crawlspace in your favorite podcatcher, Missing, and Empty Frames. That's about art heists. Thanks a lot for having us on, Andrew. This has been a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming.
Have fun playing soccer.
Oh, thank you. Oh, I probably won't. I'll probably injure myself. I'm getting old. Thanks, guys. That was a lot of fun and very educational. I learned a heck of a lot and hope you did too. Not the guys who came on the podcast because they already knew the stuff, but the people listening, which is you. Catch their podcast. That's Lance and Tim's podcast, not your own podcast. Crawl Space, Missing Maura Murray. These are two podcasts they've done. Catch them in all the normal places. They're brilliant. And there's just hundreds of episodes to crawl through. They're on Twitter and TikTok too. So am I. TikTok's booming. It's kicking off. It's picking up. Lots of new followers on there. Catch our bonus segment on patreon.com/AndrewGold. We go on chatting for a good 10-20 minutes. And follow on YouTube for the video versions. I chat on the side of the video for the live showings on Mondays and Thursdays at 9 p.m. UK time. So every new episode then goes out later that day on YouTube, and usually I'm there to chat with you all. That's all for now. Please keep reviewing this podcast on Apple and Castbox, and I'll see you next time.